"There is nothing like a dwarf," Ms. White told herself, "nothing in the world." Where else but the Dwarven Hold could you place an order for a 20-foot diameter wrought iron doughnut pan in the morning and be heating fat in it the same afternoon? And what a pan! Not just a stunningly efficient, irreproachably ergonomic kitchen utensil, but a thing of beauty, sinuously contoured and perfectly balanced. Its rim chased with gold-inlaid runes, its 10-foot handle defiantly arched like a springing leopard. Not just an object, a mere thing, but to the dwarves, things are never mere. Dwarves paint no paintings, compose no operas or symphonies, write no sonnets or great dwarven novels, but into everything they make, they pour the very essence of their being, their hearts and souls. They don't go much on fancy, useless decoration, floral borders, embossed panels of vine leaves, birds and grazing deer. That sort of thing they dismiss as elvish side salad. Instead, without sacrificing an iota of utility and function, they put beauty in every line and curve, every proportion and ratio, everything that, taken together, makes up a shape, a symmetry, a design. It took 15 strong dwarves to lift it, and 12 tons of charcoal to make a fire hot enough to melt the lard. "What's its name?" she asked, as they hauled it into position.
"You are?"
"Oh, come on. Something as big and beautiful as that's got to have a name." Pause.
"All right, if you say so. We name this pan Karez Zaraf."
Karez Zaraf. The echo of the words rolled away like distant thunder, mysterious and grand. She smiled. "That's a wonderful name," she said. "What does it mean?"
"Large pan.
I think I'll call it Peter," she said. So, into Peter went all the flour, the beaten up eggs, the milk and the butter, and shortly afterwards a crane, hastily shipped in from the minehead, winched a huge, glistening brown O out of the roiling fat. A specially adapted winch raised it 7 levels to the great inner hall, where the masons had just finished shoring up a wall for it to stand against. There was an awkward moment when a rope broke and the enormous object tottered and threatened to fall, but quick thinking on the part of the gangmasters saved the day. A volunteer jumped down from the boom of the crane, drove a handspike into the pastry, and made a chain fast to it. And then it was every hand to the ropes, to haul it back upright while the fixing brackets were screwed in. And when it was all done, King Drain took a step back, scratched the back of his neck, and said, "What in God's name is that all in aid of?"
"Ah," Ms. White said.
"Ah, what?"
"Just ah, for now. Suit yourself. So how's that going to help you get all the stuff we were talking about?"
"Ah. You know what? You're starting to get on my nerves."
She blew him a kiss. He shuddered and stomped away, leaving her alone in the vast echoing chamber with the giant doughnut.
Splendid.
She looked round to make sure all the workmen had gone, then took her loganberry from the pocket of her apron, hit the appropriate key, and waited. 3 rings. Then, "Hello?"
"White here. All right, everything's ready this end. In your own time."
"What about the money?"
"When I've had a chance to look at the stuff."
Oh, for crying out loud. All right.
Stand back. The line went dead. She hopped and skipped back a couple of paces, and just as well, the towering stack of crates that materialized out of nowhere would have been right on top of her if she hadn't moved. She stared at it for a moment, then noticed an envelope sellotaped to a front row crate. "You said that if I had any other stuff to send it through, same terms, prompt payment will oblige. How did you say this thing works? Exactly?" She hadn't said, naturally. That technology wasn't hers to license. And she had an idea that anyone who tried to double-cross smiling, harmless-looking George would quickly find themselves in a depth and diversity of trouble beyond the capacity of the human brain to imagine. Ms. White's motto had always been a simple one. Don't be too greedy. It has served her well over the years, and she respected it. She chose a crate at random and peered at the label. But it was in Chinese, which she could speak after a fashion, but not read. So she looked round and found a crowbar left behind by the construction crew, hauled the crate down off the stack, and prized open the lid. 500 sets of wine bottle stoppers in the shape of letters of the alphabet. Cool. The next crate held 1,000 leather-look cradles for carrying a bottle of wine suspended from the crossbar of a bicycle. Perfect. 18,000 combination beard combs and bottle openers. Pure gold. 500 mahogany iPhone covers, sourced from sustainable forests. Well, the last bit would be wasted on Drain and his lot, but never mind. Some fool would buy them. Some fool always does. She lined up an assortment of the stuff on the lid of a crate and gazed at it for a while. The dwarves, bless them, had never seen anything like this. Designed by cynics for sale to morons, stamped out by machines and shipped by the ton. The total antithesis of everything the dwarves stood for, and therefore as irresistible as blue jeans and rock music in Soviet Russia. The original plan had been to flog this garbage to the simple-minded sons of men in the surrounding villages. But now that she saw it with her own eyes, she knew with total certainty that the principal consumers would be the domestic market. Ugly, useless, thrown together any old fashion, and built-in obsolescence. How could any dwarf possibly resist? She tiptoed out of the chamber, as though afraid she'd wake up the sleeping treasure, and went in search of the king. She knew exactly where to find him. Behind the royal bedchamber, connected to it by a narrow passage that even a dwarf had to stoop to get through, was a tiny little cell where Drain kept his tools. Not the ancient and glorious tools of office, which were on display in the royal treasury under round-the-clock armed guard, but the ones he actually used, on the rare occasions when he managed to sneak off for 10 minutes to tinker with something. He looked up as she squeezed through the doorway. "Now what?"
"I thought you might like to come and see."
Drain was making a watch. On the bench in front of him lay dozens of tiny brass cogs, wheels, ratchets, springs and pinions. He was filing the teeth of a gear wheel no bigger than a fingernail by eye. Dwarvish watches are the best in the multiverse, but there are very few of them. Precisely 7 are made every 2 years, because, by ancient custom, Only the dwarf lords themselves are permitted to make them. Meanwhile, three levels down in a wooden crate, she had 500 white, plastic, combination, cufflink, tidy, digital alarm clocks.
See what?
Talking of seeing, the teeth of the gear wheel he was filing were minute. If she'd had a vernier caliper handy and measured them, she'd have found they were 40,000th of an inch long, and all precisely identical in length, thickness, rake, and pitch. But he wasn't using spectacles, or a magnifying glass, or a jeweler's loop. For the same reason, she didn't walk with a Zimmer frame. No need. The stuff, of course. It's all here.
What? All ready? All of it?
She nodded. Come on, she said. It'll blow your socks off.